Well, hello, this is Richard Clem, and welcome to our ethics program today. We're recording it live on April 22nd, and we're also recording it for purposes of an on-demand program. So it's going to be designed for attorneys in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, and Nebraska specifically, because that's where most of the attorneys taking this program are from. However, what we're going to be covering today is the ABA model of rules of professional conduct, which have been adopted in almost all of the states. About 40 or 45 states have adopted more or less identical rules. So even if you're in one of those other states, the program will prove somewhat useful to you today. And what we are covering, like I say, is simply an overview of the entirety of the rules of professional conduct. I always like to start out with the program with kind of a warning or a disclaimer. And the disclaimer is that, unfortunately, you're not going to get your money's worth out of today's program. And the reason why I say that is because very rarely when you have actual ethical problems that come up in the practice of law, trying to decide what exactly you have to do in some complicated ethical situation, very rarely can you simply turn to the rules and say, aha, here's specifically what I'm supposed to do, and it's printed there right in black and white. That just doesn't happen very often, because usually when the ethical dilemmas arise, they're much more complicated than that, and more often than not, it's two conflicting priorities. One rule says you're supposed to do one thing, another rule seemingly says that you're supposed to do another thing. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to resolve those difficult situations today. And for that reason, like I say, you're not going to get your money's worth out of the program. Now, before you start clamoring for a refund, though, actually you will get your money's worth out of the program in a couple of ways. One of them is that you will earn CLE credit for the program. Believe it or not, most of the attorneys who take my programs are taking them for that reason, because they need the credits. Today's live program has been approved for credit in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and the recording of this program will probably be approved for credit in other states as well. And if you just stumbled into this program from somewhere and you're wondering what it's all about, you can find more information at my website, richardclem.com. So like I say, you will get your money's worth out of it in that way. So you needn't clamor for a refund just yet. But the other thing I discovered, there actually is a little bit of practical value in today's program that you will get out of it. Because when I first started putting this program together, and I've been giving it for several years right now, the first time I put the program together, it dawned on me that I have not just sat down and read the rules of professional conduct from cover to cover for a very long time. And in fact, probably the last time I had done that, examine all of the rules from front to back, was probably back when I was in law school, getting ready to take the multi-state professional responsibility exam. So it does serve as a good review because, even though it might not answer the difficult problems, you still want to know what the starting point is, and the rules themselves are the starting point. So it is somewhat practical to get a little bit of a refresher of what is actually in the rules and what they have to say. And also a few of the rules, not very much, because they are pretty static, but some of those rules might have changed a little bit. There might have been amendments over the years. So like I say, if you probably won't have to give out too many refunds because it does have course does have those two redeeming features. Even though, like I say, it's not going to give you a lot of guidance over what you're going to be doing on the job Monday morning, but it will provide some guidance. If you want, and of course the course materials, and you, if you want to follow along with them, you can, or consult them later if you want a little bit of reference material. The course materials are pretty much just a paraphrase of what the actual text of the rules have to say. Of course, the rules themselves are controlling, not my paraphrase of them. At the beginning of the course materials, I do have links to your state's version of the rules, most of which are pretty much identical in the different states where I have most of my coverage. You'll see there are a few little differences from state to state. We'll be covering some of those today. But in general, they're pretty much the same from state to state. The main guidance I give you in those difficult situations, when you come up with that problem where you simply don't know what you're supposed to do in this difficult situation, more often than not, you will help yourself a great deal if you run that problem past a colleague. So if you have some just big ethical problem where you don't know what's going on, you don't know what you're supposed to do, talk to some other attorney. If you're in a firm, talk to one of your colleagues. If you're not in a firm, talk to some friend who's an attorney, or even pick up the phone and give me a call. Ask what you're supposed to do. Not because I'm any smarter than you are or any more ethical than you are, and chances are that other attorney down the hall isn't any smarter than you are either. But just having a fresh set of eyes look at those kinds of difficult problems can usually make, oftentimes turn a difficult problem into a much easier problem. Because unfortunately, I, for preparing my CLEs, I read a lot of Supreme Court opinions from state Supreme Courts. And unfortunately, most of those opinions are attorney discipline cases of some poor, hapless attorney who got himself in trouble for doing something or other. And almost every single time I read one of those cases, I think to myself, boy, if this attorney had just, talked to some other attorney early on in the process, they probably would have saved themselves a lot of grief. Because what happens is you get embroiled in a situation and it looks difficult and you just, start digging yourself in deeper and deeper. Whereas if you early on get a fresh set of eyes to look at the problem, oftentimes there's a much easier solution. There's a way out. So always take advantage of that. Now, for those of you in Wisconsin, you have an excellent resource in that regard. Because you're required to be a member of the Bar Association. I'm not a joiner here, so I'm not a member of the Minnesota Bar Association. But in Wisconsin, you have to be a member, so you may as well take full advantage of your membership. And one of the things that it provides is your ethics hotline. Every Wisconsin attorney I've ever talked to about that has just said, marvelous things about the advice they've gotten. So when those problems confront themselves, be sure to make use of that resource if you're a member of that bar association or some other state or county bar association that provides a similar service. As a last ditch effort, as a last resort, one resource that's available to me as a Minnesota attorney, and probably also to attorneys in other states, is I can at any time pick up the phone and call the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility, in other words, the people who regulate me, the people who are in charge of the rules, and I can ask for an advisory opinion. In some really difficult situation, I can call them up and say, I don't know what to do in this situation. What should I do? Theoretically, I guess they could change their mind. Give me some advice, and then I take it, and they, go ahead and disbar me for it anyway. Theoretically, they could do that, but that's actually never happened. So as long as you are forthright with them and you let them know all of the relevant facts, they will give you advice about what to do. It's a good idea to keep in mind that resource is there. Now, I have never taken advantage of that resource. for a couple of reasons. One is, well, I don't like talking to them. I'm afraid of them. I'm scared. I don't want to talk to them. And that's kind of a natural reaction. But also, more importantly, once you call them and ask for their advice, well, then you're kind of stuck taking their advice where it is. Because, you know, you call up and say, what should I do in this situation? And they tell you something to do. And then later on, you think of something that, you know, sounds better to you. Well, you're kind of stuck, doing what they said you should do. So that's why I've never taken advantage of that. But in some of those really difficult situations, always remember that, in Minnesota for sure, and probably in other states, that resource is there. And then finally, if after listening today to me talk about legal ethics, and you're just you have a hunger to learn more about the interesting subject of legal ethics, and you want to do some outside reading, well, then what I would recommend is the book Minnesota Legal Ethics by William Wernz. And even though the title says Minnesota, it's really relevant anywhere because it's applying pretty much the same rules. I recommend that book, and I recommend it for two reasons. One is despite covering the topic of legal ethics, it's actually a pretty interesting book the author, William Wernz, was the head of the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility for many years. So the book has a lot of interesting war stories about all of the dishonest things that Minnesota attorneys have done over the years. So it's kind of interesting reading. Better than you would think for a book entitled Legal Ethics. And the other redeeming feature of that book is the price, namely free. It's available free of charge on the Minnesota State Bar Association website. It's available to anybody. I think it's in progress. It's being released a couple chapters at a time. So I don't know if the whole book is there yet, but like I say, it's an interesting resource. So in these long days of being locked down and you need to find some interesting reading material for your Kindle or whatever, that's something you can download. Anyway, that's our introduction, and then, with that, we will just jump into the actual text of the rules. What do the Wisconsin, Minnesota, Nebraska, Iowa rules of professional conduct have to say? And the rules start with one we're not going to really spend any time on, but they start with Rule 1.0, which is simply a list of definitions. So there's nothing too compelling there, nothing particularly interesting, but just remember that there is a list of definitions. So if you are trying to figure out exactly what some other rule means, and you're trying, because you don't know what a client is for purposes of that rule, well, you can look up the definition. It's probably pretty similar to what the dictionary would tell you, so you might not get a lot of new information there. But just remember it's there. The exception to that, the two words that might mean something a little bit different from what you would think they mean are the definition of the word writing and the definition of the word signature. Because a writing, of course, well, it's, ink that's dried on a piece of paper, that, of course, is writing. Electronic writing, an email is certainly a writing. That's pretty well settled. But the rule goes even farther than that. It says that anything that's kind of preserved in any fashion is a writing for purposes of the rule. So, for example, today's CLE program, which is being recorded, and you're listening to a recording today, well, this is a writing for purposes of the rule. So just keep that in mind. I wouldn't want to bet my case on this, but if you ever get in trouble because you didn't do something in writing, maybe you left a voicemail for the person. Well, that voicemail, that's a recording, so that constitutes a writing for purposes of the rule. And similarly, the word signature is very broad. It can be, if somebody says, yes, I intend to sign this piece of paper, and you know, that probably is enough to constitute a signature, even if they don't get their pen out. So just keep it in mind. Like I say, I wouldn't want to count on that. Don't leave voicemails, you know, if the rule says to do something in writing, but that might save you. Keep that in mind. So anyway, that's just a list of definitions. But the first actual rule is Rule 1.1. Well, I warned you, you're not going to get your money's worth out of the program. Well, you're definitely not going to get your money's worth out of this one, because I'm basically just going to read the rule to you. Rule 1.1 says that you're supposed to be competent. It says you shall provide competent representation to your clients. But then, unfortunately, it doesn't really define what competent means very much, other than that it requires legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and preparation that are reasonably necessary. So, in other words, we'll know it when we see it. I'm sure we could spend hours talking about what constitutes competent representation. Just be reminded that competence, in addition to what our clients pay for, one of our ethical obligations. Now, if you're, let's say I need some brain surgery, so I go track down a brain surgeon, and it's his first brain surgery. He just graduated from medical school. He's going to operate on me. Can that person be competent? Well, yes, that person can be competent. So just because it's his first time doing it doesn't mean he's not competent. Competence means that you might need to acquire the requisite level of competence from reasonable preparation. So I hope he was paying attention the day they studied brain surgery or whatever. So competence does not necessarily mean 100 years of experience, but it has to acquire that competence as is reasonable under the circumstances. So that's the first rule. Just says, you're supposed to be competent as an attorney. But we already knew that. The next rule is what I. If you ask me what is the most important rule, I'll tell you that it's Rule 1.2. So we'll spend a little bit more time talking about that. And the reason why I say that Rule 1.2 is the most important rule is that it kind of lays out our job description as attorneys. It tells us exactly what do attorneys do. So if anybody asks you, what does an attorney do? You can point to Rule 1.2. And it will tell you exactly what we do as attorneys. Unfortunately, what we do as attorneys is not very glamorous because Rule 1.2, what is our job description? Our job description is abide by your client's decisions. So in other words, what's our job description? Our job description is to do exactly what our client tells us to do, period. That's not very exciting or very interesting, but that's a thread that runs throughout the rules. You always have to abide by your client's decisions, period. It's a very absolute rule. But, of course, there are some exceptions, and we'll talk about some of those exceptions throughout the program. We'll talk about some of those exceptions here in just a minute. But it's written in terms of an absolute rule. You always have to do exactly what your client tells you to do, unless you can point to the exception. So in other words, anytime you depart from what your client tells you to do, the burden of proof will be on you to show that it fits within one of those exceptions. And we'll talk about, like I say, those exceptions later on. But first, let's talk about some of the exceptions that are not here. The rule does not say that you shall abide by your client's decisions, comma, unless it would not be in your client's best interest to do so. No, it doesn't say that. It says you always have to abide by your client's decisions, even if your client is wrong, even if your client wants to do something foolish. Now, the client who wants to do something foolish, you might be able to find an exception And we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But it's not just an exception that I was doing it for my client's own good, because they said they wanted me to do this, and I did some other thing for them, and look, it even turned out great. But no, you're supposed to abide by your client's decisions. Even if your client wants to do something foolish, even if your client wants to do something unwise. Well, the rule then goes on to say that, well, because, you know, that's all we're doing. We're just following orders. We're doing what our clients tell us to do. So therefore, the corollary of that is, therefore, our representation does not constitute an endorsement of the client's political, economic, social, or moral views or activities. So in other words, we're just doing our job, and we're not endorsing our clients. So I don't know, when non-attorneys are talking to me and they want to have a deep philosophical, intellectual discussion, sometimes they will ask, even though I really don't have anything to do with criminal law, but they'll ask me something like, well, would you represent a guilty person? And by asking that question, they think I'm going to do a lot of soul searching and everything. And I don't. I blow the question off, and they say, well, of course I would represent the guilty person, because the guilty person needs the attorney a lot more than the innocent person does. Well, the reason why I can say that is because of this rule. I'm just following orders. I'm just abiding by my client's decisions. Yeah, my client is, guilty as they get, but the decision was to plead not guilty. And my duty is to carry that out and represent him at trial. Now, my duty to do it competently would probably try to talk to him, saying, well, maybe you should take that plea deal. But ultimately, it's the client's decision, and I am not endorsing their criminal behavior simply because I continue to represent them. Because that's their decision, pleading guilty or not guilty. I mean, that's like the ultimate decision. But anyway, you always have to abide by your client's decisions, but by doing so, you're not endorsing their activities. Now, like I say, there are many exceptions to that. The first one is right here, and you already knew this. You're not supposed to help your client commit a crime. You shall not assist a client in conduct that you know is criminal or fraudulent. Well, you knew that. I didn't have to tell you that. The client says, "Hey, I want to record this fraudulent document. Can you take it to the county recorder's office?" Well, of course not. The client says, I'm going to rob a bank. Can you drive the getaway car for me? Well, of course not, because then you're assisting in conduct that you know is criminal or fraudulent. So that's pretty easy. You didn't have to pay me to tell you that. Where it gets a little bit more difficult, though, is the exception to that exception. Because even though you're not allowed to help your client commit crimes, what you are permitted to do, and really what you're required to do, is you can discuss the legal consequences of your client's proposed course of conduct to make a good faith effort to determine the scope, meaning, or application of the law. And I think what they're getting at there would be a hypothetical something like the following. I'm representing the defendant in this criminal trial that starts on Monday morning. Things aren't looking that good. It looks like maybe the client will get convicted. But they're out on bail right now, and they call me up, and my client asks, does the United States have an extradition treaty with Venezuela? I go to the library and look up the treaty with Venezuela, and I come to the conclusion that, there's still a treaty in effect, but given the current diplomatic conditions, in my expert legal opinion, that treaty is unenforceable right now. So in other words, if my client figures out a way to get to Venezuela, they will have successfully avoided prosecution. So they So I tell them, yep, there's no extradition treaty with Venezuela. If you go to Venezuela, there's no way you can be prosecuted. Now, I should probably tell them the negative effects too, because I'm supposed to be a competent lawyer, so I have to tell them. But things aren't going so good in Venezuela right now. You'll have to. They don't have anything to eat because they finished eating all of the zoo animals already. So, that's not a good place to go. But I give them the information, and sure enough, they flee to Venezuela. Am I in trouble for assisting in illegal conduct? Well, I don't think so, because I fit pretty squarely within that exception to the exception. I was simply discussing the legal consequences, and the client made that decision. I gave him the information to determine the scope, meaning, or application of the law. So I think I'm in pretty good shape. Now, others might not be quite so charitable, though. So when I get to the courthouse on Monday morning for the trial, and the judge asks, where's the defendant? And I say, I think the defendant might be in Venezuela. I'll probably have some splaining to do if that happens. So that's probably one of those situations where if I did get that phone call, I probably would call the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility and say, what do I do in this situation? Or if you're a Wisconsin attorney, that would probably be a very good candidate to call the ethics hotline. But like I say, I think it's pretty clear that just providing that information is not really problematic. At this time, for the podcast listeners, I'm going to give our first code number for this program, and our first code number is E136. E136. As in ethics, E136 is the first code number for this part of the program. So that's the most important rule. Always abide by your client's decision, subject to that exception of not helping with illegal stuff, but that exception is subject to the exception of, but you can give information. A couple of other subjects covered by Rule 1.2. Can you limit the scope of the representation? Well, yeah, obviously. If it's reasonable, and the client has to give informed consent. Your client is charged with DWI because you're a drunk driving attorney. And they're charged with the criminal offense of DWI, but they also got into an accident. Somebody's suing them. Is it reasonable to say, well, I'm only a criminal defense attorney, so I'll represent you for the criminal charges, but the civil case you have to take elsewhere? That's fine. It's reasonable. It sounds reasonable to me. And the client consents to it. The client has to give informed consent. Where you have to watch out is the requirement that consent has to be confirmed in writing. So anytime you have a situation where you are limiting the scope of the representation, make sure that there's a writing in existence. It doesn't have to be a formal contract signed by anybody or anything, but it just has to be a writing saying, I'm representing you in matter A, but I'm not representing you in matter B, and you consented to that, you said it was reasonable. So make sure that writing exists anytime there's a limitation on the scope of your representation. Now, when you think about it, pretty much any time somebody retains you, that you become somebody's attorney, well, they're hiring you for that one thing that they hired you for, and they're not hiring you for anything else. So an argument could be made that any time somebody retains your services, you're limiting the scope of the representation, and this rule kicks in. I mean, that's reasonable, because they hired you for, to fight their jaywalking ticket. That's what they hired you for. But when they get charged with murder 10 years from now, you didn't sign up for that, so you're limiting the scope of the representation to the one thing that's there today. So the reason why that might be a little bit problematic is, well, nowhere in the rules does it say that attorney retainer contracts have to be in writing. But this says that anytime you limit the scope of the representation, there has to be a writing. So a good practice is that anytime somebody retains your services, there should be some kind of writing in existence. And as we see when we get to the fee, that also strongly implies that there should be a writing in most cases. So like I say, it's not an absolute rule saying that, attorneys can only be hired in writing. But like I say, there's a pretty strong case could be made that there some kind of writing should be in existence because of this rule and another rule that we'll talk about in a few minutes. Now, okay, so that's that hereby concludes our discussion of Rule 1.2 in Wisconsin and Iowa and Minnesota. Nebraska has another provision that I'm going to talk about briefly. So if you're a Nebraska attorney, definitely pay attention. But even attorneys in other states should maybe think about this. And that's the question of can I limit the scope of my representation to preparing documents that will be used by pro se litigants? So in other words, this person is getting sued and they have to file an answer. And they're out looking for an attorney to represent them, and you're not able to represent them, but the answer is due tomorrow. So they say, well, can't you at least, prepare the documents that I need to file? So I've done that occasionally, either an answer or a complaint or something, a document that I prepare for a client. I don't sign it. I'm not their lawyer, but I, write a document that they will sign. So I'll give them instructions. Here you sign here, and then you, take one copy to the courthouse and give the other copy to the other side, et cetera. Explain what to do with it. Is that okay? Well, yeah, that sounds reasonable. That limitation on the scope of my representation is reasonable. The client consented to it. We even had it in writing that they consented, so that's fine. But the issue that comes up, and Nebraska has addressed it very on a very straightforward manner. Other states might be up in the air a little bit. Am I kind of in some way misleading the court and concealing my involvement by doing that? Now, I don't think so. I think that's a perfectly appropriate thing to do. But on the other hand, an argument could be made that, wait a minute, this document is signed by, Joe Plaintiff, and it's actually written by this professional attorney who is concealing the fact that he was involved in it. That sounds like a little bit of a stretch to me, but somebody could make that argument. Well, the Nebraska rule provides kind of a safe harbor, the rule says yes, that is definitely an appropriate thing for attorneys to do, prepare documents for pro se litigants. But in Nebraska, you have to disclose the fact. So down at the bottom of the document, you have to say, this document was drafted by, and put your name and address. So it's kind of a good practice. That's what I do. Because unless there is a good reason for concealing my involvement, that kind of insulates me from that argument. So I'll either put that in there or in some way bring it to the court's attention. One time I did one of those things, and I took it upon myself to serve the papers on the other side. So in the affidavit of service, I said, my role in this case is process server, and on this date I mailed the documents to this address. I am an attorney, but I'm not entering an appearance in the case. So I disclose it, and probably, like I say, the best way to do is just, down at the bottom, like with wills. When you write a will, in Minnesota anyway, probably the same in other states, I put this document drafted by and put my name and address. So including that in those kind of pleadings would be a good idea. I guess the magic words in Nebraska are prepared by. and also Nebraska has a rule that's unique to Nebraska. And this in Minnesota, you know, if I enter an appearance in a criminal case, as we'll see later on, I'm in it for the duration. So you know, if a client just says, "Well, can you come and hold my hand while I plead not guilty, and I'll get another attorney for the actual trial?" I tell them, "No, I'm not going to do that," because once I show up in the courtroom with any connection with this case, so Nebraska, I think, wisely has a rule saying you can enter a limited appearance. You know, that just says I'm here for the arraignment and for no other purpose, and I'm, you know, he's going to have to find somebody else to go to trial. So I wish we had that rule in Minnesota, but we don't. So in general, we don't. Okay, so anyway, that's Rule 1.2, like I say, which I kind of identify as the most important rule. And then also it has those other little subsidiary things going along with it. Rule 1.3 is the rule that says not to procrastinate. So if you are a Minnesota attorney taking this program on June 30th, and don't worry, you're in good company. That's one of my busiest days because that's the deadline. Or again, if the other deadline, August 31st or December 31st for attorneys in other states, they always get a little bit nervous when they see this because, well, they were procrastinating. But not to worry, because Rule 1.3 says you shall act with reasonable diligence and promptness in representing a client. So why did you put your CLE off until the last minute? Well, because you've been so busy representing your clients. So you're actually to be commended for waiting until the last minute. But when it comes to client matters, you're not supposed to procrastinate. You shall act with reasonable diligence and promptness. Why? Well, first of all, it's a violation of this rule. But number two, as the comment says, no professional shortcoming is more widely resented than procrastination. So if the client will notice that you're procrastinating, and they'll find they'll complain, and that's a reason to complain. So don't give them a reason to complain. So don't procrastinate when it comes to representing your clients. Well, what do attorneys most often procrastinate about with regard to their clients? It's probably the next rule: communication, not returning phone calls. So don't procrastinate in general, but specifically, don't procrastinate when it comes to communications, especially bad news. You know, if you have if you get the notice in the mail that you won the case, well, you're going to call the client right away. But when the notice comes that says that you lost the case, well, there's kind of a natural tendency to drag your feet on that. But don't, because you have a duty to communicate, especially when it comes to bad news. Fortunately, Rule 1.4 says you have to communicate. Fortunately, the burden is not particularly large, your duty of communication. It says that you have to communicate in a number of different situations, a couple of specific ones. Anytime your client has to consent to something, you have to, if there are any relevant limitations on your conduct. So, the limitation is, you're going to be on vacation next week, or you're not admitted in that, one of the jurisdictions where you could possibly file it or something. So if there's any limitation on your conduct, you have to communicate that. Consent always has to be communicated. But in general, your duty to communicate is simply let the client know how their objectives are going to be carried out, keep them informed of the status of the case, and comply with their reasonable request for information. So as long as your client kind of has a general idea of what's going on, you've met your obligation. And you don't, have to go any further than that. You do not have to communicate every little thing in excruciating detail. Now, having said that, though, you will never get in trouble if you over-communicate. You might get into trouble if you under-communicate. So it's always best to err on the side of caution, I think, and over communicate. But like I say, the you know, just in general, you have to keep them informed of what's going on. You can't just leave them totally in the dark. So as long as you're making reasonably known what's happening, you're good under Rule 1.4. And the test of have you communicated enough is, well, remember, Rule 1.2 says the client gets to make all decisions. So the test is, did you give them enough information so that they can intelligently participate in those decisions? And as long as you've done that, you're good. You've met your obligation under Rule 1.4. But, like I say, you can always err on the side of caution and over-communicate. Well, that brings us up to Rule 1.5, which talks about fees. So the good news is we're allowed to charge money for our services. Our clients can pay us. That's good. And really the only restriction on that is that our fees and expenses can't be unreasonable. And there the drafters of the rule even cut us a little bit of a break by using that double negative, which seems to me that the burden of proof will be on somebody else to show that it's unreasonable, rather than us having to show that they're reasonable. So that's good. As long as you charge a fee, that's okay. As long as it's not unreasonable. But the definition of reasonable though is kind of left in the open. All the rule does is list a bunch of factors that will be taken into consideration. Time and labor required, novelty and difficulty, whether it will preclude you from taking on other employment, the customary charge in your area, the amount involved and the results obtained, time limitations, the nature and length of your relationship with the client, your experience and reputation, that's a relevant factor, and finally, whether or not it's fixed or contingent. We'll talk about that in a minute. What's a reasonable fee? Well, we'll know it when we see it, the court will look at those factors in making that determination. Now, I have certainly never broken that rule. I have never in my life even come close to charging an unreasonable fee. If anything, my fees are unreasonably low, that's not a problem. I've never broken that rule. But if I've ever broken a rule, it's the next rule. Or if I've come close to breaking a rule. Because the next part of this rule says that the fee and scope of representation shall be communicated to the client, preferably in writing. So now how might I have violated that? Well, I might have violated that because I'm such a nice guy. The phone rings and somebody asks me to perform some legal services for them, and I agree to do so, and I quote them a price over the phone, and then I just get to work, and I'll send them a bill later. So they need a deed drafted. So they call me up and say, can you draft a deed for me? And sure, I'll look up the legal description online and I'll get the deed ready for you and I'll charge you $100. And that's certainly a very reasonable price. So they agree to it. I do the work. I send it to them. I send them a bill. Maybe I violated this rule because I communicated the fee information and the scope of the representation, but I didn't do it in writing. What I should have done in that situation was I should have followed it up with some kind of a writing. Just send them an email saying, thank you for calling today. I'll get right to work on that, and it'll cost $100. And then I would have been fine. But I didn't do that. So now I've never gotten disbarred for doing that, and if I ever did get in trouble, I guess I would throw myself on the mercy of the Minnesota Supreme Court and say the rule says preferably. So it's maybe not an absolute rule. Then there's the question of, well, why didn't you do it in the way that everybody agrees is the preferable way of doing things? And I don't know if I have an answer to that question. So, yeah, I should preferably do that in writing. Now, those of you in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Supreme Court actually cut you a little bit of a break. And if I were a Wisconsin attorney, I never would have gotten in trouble for that, because in Wisconsin there's an exception. And the exception is that if the reasonably foreseeable cost is under $1,000, then that information can be communicated orally. So I would not have gotten into trouble as a Wisconsin attorney doing that same thing, because it was $100, it wasn't $1,000. Now, that's a little bit of a two-edged sword, though, because, that's good for you if you're in Wisconsin, but also, if I had a $1,001 case, I could probably get away with telling the court, well, yeah, but the rule says preferably. So I communicated, I told the client it was going to cost $1,001. I did it orally. Yeah, I should have done it the preferable way, but I didn't. I probably get away with that. Well, since you have such a, in Wisconsin, have such a, black and white number there, you probably can't get away with that argument. So you have to be a little bit more careful maybe in those cases that are a little bit larger. So, but like I say, I think that's a wise compromise that the Wisconsin, version of the rule adds in, But like I say, that's probably still best practice. And like I say, that other rule, the scope or the any relevant limitations limitation in the scope of the representation has to be communicated in writing in Rule 1.2, kind of implies, especially together with this one, saying that, yeah, any time a client hires you, there should be some kind of writing kind of the bare minimum of details. It doesn't have to be a contract or anything. It's a writing from you satisfies the obligation. So like I say, that's the rule that if I've ever broken one of these rules or come close to it, that's probably the one. Contingent fees. Contingent fees are okay. Now, the definition of contingent fee is a little bit broader than what we might expect. And a contingent fee means that your fee varies in some way, can be in any way, in connection with what happened in the case. So normally when I say contingent fee, we think that means the lawyer gets one third and the client gets two thirds. That's certainly a contingent fee. But a contingent fee means any time the results vary depending on what happens in the case. But they're allowed. Contingent fees are allowed in any kind of case whatsoever, with two exceptions. First is family law cases. So certainly you can't I'm going to get one third of the alimony. Well, the family court probably wouldn't go for that, but it would be a violation of this rule also. So you can't do that. But it's broader than that, because remember, the contingent fee means any time the fee varies. No fee unless there is a restraining order or whatever. Then that would be a contingent fee in a family law case. Similarly, no contingent fees in criminal cases. So a contingent fee in a criminal case would be, no charge unless you're acquitted. That would be a violation of this rule, in addition to probably not being a very sustainable business practice. But interestingly, the leading case on this subject comes from Wisconsin, where an attorney, I believe in Madison, represented people in drunk driving cases, and he was advertising that he would win your case or you would get a free bicycle. So kind of a clever advertising method, kind of a win-win situation for everybody. So he wins your case. Well, everything goes back to the way it was before. You can drive. You have a driver's license. You have a car. Everything is good. Or maybe things don't go quite as well as they could have, and maybe you lose your driver's license. Well, your transportation needs are still taken care of, because in that case you get a bicycle. But the Wisconsin Supreme Court said no, you can't do that, because that's a contingent fee in a criminal case. Because you know he's getting a certain fee, but he gets that fee minus the price of the bicycle in cases he loses, and that's enough to make it a contingent fee in a criminal case and not permitted. The other subject talked about in Rule 1.5 is fee splitting. Now, before we talk about this rule, we're going to jump ahead to, I think it's Rule 7.2, because Rule 7.2, which we'll cover in more detail later, says that attorneys cannot get a referral fee, period. Referral fees are against the law. You cannot pay somebody to refer cases to you, because that's just not permitted. Referral fees are illegal. They're not permitted. Interestingly, that's not true in all states. Michigan, for example, has referral fees, and California, I believe, does. But not in Wisconsin, not in Minnesota, not in Iowa, not in Nebraska. Referral fees are against the law, period. It's just not allowed. Now, when I say that, occasionally an attorney will jump in and say, well, wait a minute. I thought referral fees were okay in my state as long as I jumped through the following hoops. And if they say that, they're not really wrong, because we're going to talk about those hoops here in a minute. Because there is something similar to referral fees, and that similar thing is okay as long as you jump through all the right hoops. Even if there was also a referral involved in the case. So the attorney is not really wrong when they say that referral fees are okay as long as you do the following things. They're not really wrong in saying that, but on the other hand, it's kind of unfortunate use of language, because it's similar to saying that murder is legal in this state. It is legal to murder people. You can murder somebody if you want to, and it's perfectly okay as long as you're acting in self-defense. Well, that statement is not really wrong, but if it's self-defense, well, then it's not murder. So it's kind of sloppy use of language. So if the one thing you remember today is referral fees are not permitted. And even if you do get referral fees, don't admit guilt by calling it that. Call it something else. And that something else is here. Because even though it is not permitted to have a referral fee, well, what is certainly permitted is I did half the work in the case, and you did half the work in the case, right? So we split the labor, and then we get the money to pay for our labor. What do we do with it? We split it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, because you're just getting paid for the work that you did, and I'm getting paid for the work I did, and we split the fee. So this rule allows that. It's okay to split fees between more than one attorney, as long as it's in proportion to the services provided by each lawyer. Now, here, the different states use a little bit different language. Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, the rule says it's in proportion to the work provided by each lawyer. Wisconsin, I think, I forget what word they used. I think it's in relation to or something. They used a little bit different word just to stress the fact that it doesn't have to be with mathematical certainty. I did half the work, and you did half the work, but you're getting two-thirds of the money, and I'm getting one-third of the money. Well, that's still okay, because it's in relation to the services we're provided, even though it's not, divided, to the penny. And I think that's how a court, I think in Minnesota or Iowa or Nebraska, would interpret things, even though the word proportion is in there. But Wisconsin just wanted to kind of stress that. So anyway, that's what the rule says. You can split fees with another attorney as long as both lawyers worked on the case. Well, now the first time I gave this CLE program, as I mentioned, my course materials here are kind of a paraphrase, and I don't include every single word from the rules. So I just left it at that, and I say, okay, now we're going to move on and talk about confidentiality. And then I got a frantic email from one of the attorneys in the audience telling me that I had left off some important words, and in fact I had. Because what the rule says, it doesn't just say that you can split the fee based on services provided by each lawyer, but you can also split the fee in cases in which both attorneys maintain responsibility for the case. So we have this case we're working on together, but I'm not really doing much work. You're doing all the work. And I'm not really doing any work, but I am maintaining responsibility for the case. Well, I can be compensated for maintaining responsibility. I can't be compensated for the fact that I referred the case to you, because that would be a referral fee, and remember, a referral fee is illegal. But I can be compensated for maintaining responsibility in the case. So that's how... because there are referral fees, so I send a case to the big personal injury firm downtown, and then I don't do anything, and then I get a check from them. But if I get that check and it says, down in the memo line it says referral fee, then I should send the check back and say I'm not going to cash this, because that referral fees are not allowed. But they can compensate me for maintaining responsibility in the case, even though I also happen to refer it to them. But, that's not what they're paying me for. So that's kind of the fiction that referral fees get squeezed under, that we're both maintaining responsibility. And what does responsibility mean? The Wisconsin rule says it very explicitly, I think it would be the same result anywhere. Basically, the level of responsibility is I basically am telling the client, look, I'm referring it to this other firm downtown, but if they commit malpractice, even though I didn't do anything wrong, I want you to come and sue me for their malpractice. So that's the level of responsibility that you have to maintain, which would make me a little bit uncomfortable, so I probably wouldn't do that unless I really was working very closely on the case. Anyway, splitting fees is okay. Referral fees are not, but splitting is okay as long as it's in proportion to services or in light of responsibility that's maintained. And that covers Rule 1.5. We're at the top of the hour here. I will just give our next code number for our podcast listeners. The next code number for this part of the program is E-235, E-235, E-235 is the first code number for this portion of the program. And we'll turn to confidentiality in just a second here, as long as I'm going to get a sip of water here first. Okay, we'll go for about another half hour, then take a break before we continue complete the 3 hours of the program. Okay, Rule 1.6 talks about confidentiality. Before we talk about Rule 1.6, I want to stress what we are not talking about, because... there's a related concept called the attorney-client privilege. And obviously there are some similarities, but for our purposes, they're very, very different concepts. So just briefly, what the attorney-client privilege is that if a client comes and talks to me because I'm their lawyer and they're getting legal advice, or it could be because I'm a doctor and I'm dispensing medical advice or whatever, but the information that they share with me is privileged. So in other words, my client or my patient comes to me and says, I just committed a robbery yesterday. They tell me that information. Well, that information is privileged. Well, lo and behold, I get a subpoena to appear before the grand jury. And the grand jury wants to know, and they ask me, what did your client tell you yesterday? Well, normally if the grand jury asks a question, I'm supposed to answer it. But in this case, my correct answer would be, I refuse to answer that because the information is privileged. And I wouldn't go to jail or anything, even though I refuse to answer the question. So that's what the attorney-client privilege is. Well, I don't know about you, but that particular scenario that I just said, well, that's never happened to me. I've never had to deal with that. I've never been subpoenaed to appear in front of a grand jury. I've never been asked to disclose what my client told me. You know, I suppose maybe it's come up in some kind of tangential way, but it's really safe to say that I have never had to deal with the attorney-client privilege ever in the practice of law. It's just never come up because I've never been asked to, you know, nobody's tried to force me to say what my client told me. I've never said I refuse to answer because of the attorney-client privilege. That's just never happened. That's kind of, you know, that's, you know, kind of far-fetched that anything like that would happen. So in other words, it's not a subject we have to worry about very much. On the other hand, Rule 1.6 is talking about something very different, because what Rule 1.6 says, that everything that you know that takes place during your workday, you know, anything that relates to the representation of a client is presumptively confidential, and you shall not reveal that information to anyone. So unlike the attorney-client privilege, which is never an issue, this kind of confidentiality is always an issue. You know, everything that I know about my clients is presumptively confidential, and I am charged with never disclosing that information ever, unless I can find an exception for it. So the important thing to remember about Rule 1.6 is that whenever you disclose information about your clients, well, you have to be able to point to the reason. You have to be able to point to the exception. And you have to do that all the time because, well, what do we do as attorneys? Well, you know, there's a reason why, you know, the word mouthpiece refers to an attorney is because we're always disclosing information about our clients. That's what we're paid for. You know the client was injured in an accident, and why are they hiring you? Well, they're hiring you to tell the insurance company and to tell the judge and to tell the jury. They're hiring you to disclose information. But you have to, you know, kind of when you do that, when you're doing your job, you know, the burden of proof will be on you to show that that was an appropriate disclosure. Because the general rule is you shall not reveal information about your clients, period, unless it fits within one of the exceptions. So the exceptions, some of them are stated here, your client consents, obviously. But the biggest exception would be disclosures that are impliedly authorized in order to carry out the representation. So in other words, they hired you to share information about you. So that's, you know, it's necessary because that's what they hired you for. So like I say, the burden of proof will always be on you. Anytime you disclose information about your client, which is what you're always doing, you have to be prepared to say that, yes, it was for a proper purpose, namely because it was impliedly authorized to carry out the representation. And there might be other exceptions, other reasons to not follow confidentiality stated throughout the rules. But that's the main rule, is everything is confidential unless it's necessary or it fits within some other exception. Now, that first exception is stated right here. And this is one that, if this one comes up all the time, well, maybe you should maybe think about getting a little bit better group of clients. But what if you discover that your client is about to commit a crime? What are your obligations then? In other words, you discover that there's going to be a crime. What you do depends on what state you're in. What we will do is we will actually start with Nebraska and work our way up. So let's all pretend, if you're a Nebraska attorney, this applies to you, and you, when we're done, you don't have to listen to the rest of it. But the rest of you, let's just pretend we're sitting in our Omaha office, and your client is sitting there, and he says, you know what, I'm going to go commit a murder right now. I'm going to go murder somebody. They storm out of the office to, and you know exactly where they're going, because that's how hypotheticals are. This murder is about to take place, and you're in Nebraska. So you you get out your Nebraska rule book and see what you're supposed to do in this situation, and it says that you may reveal information. So it's confidential. Remember, it starts out confidential. This information that you learned, but you may reveal the information if you think it's necessary to keep the client from committing a crime. Well, that certainly applies here. So under the Nebraska rules of professional conduct, you are permitted to pick up the phone and call 911 and say, there's a murder about to take place. You might want to send a couple officers over to this address. You are permitted to do that, despite the general rule of confidentiality, because the Nebraska court rules say that you're permitted to do that. So that's what you do. But, well, it's late in the day. You've had a long day. You know, the weekend is coming up. If you call the cops, it's gonna ruin the rest of your day. So you decide to do nothing. Well, you're okay under this rule because the rule simply says that you are permitted to reveal that information to stop this crime from taking place. So you decide to do nothing. Your client murders somebody, but that's not your problem. That's the Nebraska rule. Now, those of us in other states, those of us in Minnesota and Wisconsin, we are just morally outraged to hear that these lawyers in Nebraska are literally letting their clients get away with murder, that we just won't put up with that here in other states such as Minnesota. So Minnesota, the Minnesota Supreme Court, that's something we're not going to put up with. We're going to change the wording. We are going to say that you shall reveal the information if you think it's necessary to prevent the client from committing a crime. So that same hypothetical doesn't take place in Nebraska. It takes place in Minnesota. My obligations are very different. I am required to call the police in that situation because I may do it or I shall do it, depending on whatever state I'm in, if it's a serious crime that will result in death or serious bodily injury or a substantial amount of financial loss. So that certainly applies there. There's certainly going to be great bodily harm from this murder. So I can pat myself on the back as being morally superior, and I feel good about that. But, well, there's a little bit of a problem with my state's approach, because let's change the hypothetical a little bit. So now we are in our office, either in Minnesota or Nebraska, it doesn't matter, and we discover that our kleptomaniac client is going to head down to Walmart and commit some petty shoplifting. So I discovered that this crime is about to take place. I get out the rule book, and it says that I may reveal the information or I shall reveal the information, depending on what state I'm in, if I think it's necessary to keep a crime from taking place. Oh, yeah, there's going to be a crime, but it has to be a serious crime. It has to result in death or serious bodily injury or substantial amount of property damage. He's just going to steal a candy bar. So there's no substantial amount of money. So therefore, my obligations are the same, whether I'm in Nebraska or Minnesota. As a competent lawyer, I should probably try to talk the client out of doing that. But ultimately, I can't call up Walmart security and say, hey, look, out for the shoplifter that's about to come in, because that information is confidential. I learned it in connection with the representation of a client. So that's a pretty easy case. Where it gets a little bit more difficult, though, is, well, my client's not going to steal a candy bar, but he's going to steal $1,000. What do I do? Well, in Nebraska, I would say, well, let's look at the rule. It says you may reveal information if it's a serious crime. It has to be a substantial amount of money. And is $1,000 a substantial amount of money? I don't know. So what I would tell the Nebraska attorney in that situation is to err on the side of caution. And you know, it's confidential. So no, you can't call up the victim and tell them that their $1,000 is about to get stolen because it's confidential. Whereas in Minnesota and Wisconsin, I don't know the answer to that question, because if it turns out, it all hinges on whether $1,000 is substantial. And if it turns out it's substantial, then I'm required to turn my client in. If it's insubstantial, I'm required not to turn them in. And I don't know exactly where that dividing line is. So that's a little bit problematic. So I see the wisdom of the Nebraska approach. And also, I've met a lot of these Nebraska attorneys. They're pretty nice guys. They would probably do the right thing anyway. So I think there's some wisdom into that approach. Wisconsin adds a little bit of language talking about whether you also have that ability to reveal information in situations that maybe do not rise to the level of a crime, but still might be a serious situation. So I kind of sense that the Wisconsin Supreme Court was trying to deal with that hypothetical a little bit. The Iowa version is also a little bit different, because the state of Iowa, like Nebraska, uses the word may. It says you may reveal information in those situations, but they go on to say that they shall do it if the danger is imminent. So the only difference I can think of is in Minnesota, if my client says that they're going to commit murder tomorrow, I'm supposed to do something about it. Whereas the attorney in Iowa maybe doesn't have to do anything about it until tomorrow. They still have to make the call. So I don't know if that makes a lot of difference anyway. But so like I say, hopefully that doesn't come up too often in your day-to-day practice of law, although it does. I had one attorney at one of these programs who afterwards she came to me and said, "Hey, oh, yeah, my client did say they were going to murder somebody," because she was a divorce attorney, and her client came in one day and handed over the hit list. Said, "Well, I'm going to murder my ex-wife, and then I'm going to murder her lawyer, and then I'm going to murder the judge." And her name was absent from the list. But what do you do in a situation like that? That's complicated. And what she did was she called her state bar association and said, "Help, what do I do?" And they were able to give her some very good practical guidance. So unfortunately, those things do come up. So you have to have a certain level of preparedness for them. Couple of other exceptions to confidentiality. If you have a dispute with a client, you're suing them or they're suing you after the case is over. Well, if that information is relevant, you can share confidential information when you do call the ethics hotline to secure legal advice about your conduct under these rules, or to comply with a law or court order. So in some of those tricky situations where you don't really know if you're supposed to disclose it or not, well, you can kind of, if you manufacture a situation where the judge orders you to tell the information, that might be kind of a safe harbor too. Although, as a competent lawyer, if the judge just asks you to reveal confidential information, well, maybe you need to appeal that. And you can disclose just enough confidential information to see if there's a conflict of interest. So anyway, that gets us through Rule 1.6, confidentiality. The next rule, 1.7, we're just going to gloss over extremely fast because I can't do it justice in this program. Because Rule 1.7 talks about conflicts of interest. And it merely says that conflicts of interest are bad and you're not supposed to do them. But it doesn't really give you very much guidance. It says obviously you can't represent both parties who are suing each other. You can't represent both the plaintiff and the defendant. That's pretty easy. But the general rule is that there's a significant risk that your representation of one or more of your clients may be materially limited. So what does that mean? Well, that could mean anything. Now, I did put together another conflicts of interest program, either a one-hour version or a three-hour version. So depending on when you're listening to this, it might be available. And I thought to myself, when I have a three-hour conflict of interest program, I'll certainly be able to answer every question that everybody possibly would have about conflicts of interest. But even then, I just scratched the surface. That's one area where you're definitely not going to get your money's worth from today's program because what exactly does that mean, conflict of interest? So we're just going to move on and talk about other things, not because that rule is unimportant, but just because, we really can't address it in the limited amount of time we have. We are going to spend more time, though, talking about Rule 1.8, which also covers conflicts of interest. But don't get the idea that Rule 1.8 is more important because we're spending more time on it. Because, the heart of the conflict of interest rule is Rule 1.7, saying never take a case if there's a significant risk that, your representation will be materially limited. That's the main rule. Rule 1.8 covers a bunch of miscellaneous conflict of interest rules, some of which are, pretty obscure, that do not come up very often. But we're going to spend more time talking about them because, we're talking about, the specific rules. But don't get the idea that Rule 1.8 is more important because it's not. Let me give another code number here before I forget. Third code number is E-375. E-375 is our next code number for this part of the program. As we turn to Rule 1.8, and again, there are some specific rules here. First of all, normally when you think conflict of interest, you're thinking of, you have two clients who have adverse interests. Rule 1.8 starts by talking about the situation where you have a personal conflict of interest. You have an interest adverse to your client. So, for example, a security interest, or you owe money to your client, or your client owes money to you. So, in other words, you have entered into some kind of transaction with your client, either that is connected with the practice of law, or maybe it's unconnected. So, in other words, you might have an adverse interest with your client. So, for example, your client is a car dealer, and you represent them, all kinds of stuff. Certainly reasonable when it's time for you to buy a car, you're going to buy it from your client. But what if it turns out to be a lemon? So you buy this lemon from your car dealer client, and you have an adverse interest. You want to sue them because of this bad car that you acquired, or the potential for that. So remember, any time that you enter into any kind of a transaction with your client, this rule might come up. But it's permissible. You can have an interest adverse to your client. So you owe your money to your client because, or for whatever reason. As long as the transaction is fair and reasonable, you're buying a car. You paid the same price anybody would. Fair and reasonable. The client consents, and you advise the client in writing to obtain outside legal advice. Now, let me tell you a story about an attorney who took this program who told me that he got in trouble for violating this rule, and I think his case is kind of instructive. So with his permission, I'm sharing this. He said that he was the attorney for his wife's family business. So his wife's parents owned a business, and he worked for that business as their attorney. So as a result of that, his wife's parents were also his client. So what happened is during the marriage, the couple bought a house or something, and they needed money for the down payment. So they borrowed money for the down payment from the in-laws, from the wife's parents. So as a result of that, he owed money to his client. He had an adverse interest with his client. So he entered into that transaction. But it was okay because it was fair and reasonable, and they consented to it. But unfortunately, they wound up getting divorced, and it turned into an ugly divorce. At one point, the wife's parents marched into the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility to file a complaint. Their complaint was that, their no good son-in-law attorney acquired an interest adverse to them, to their client, because he owed money. So they asked, okay, well, was it reasonable? Yeah, it was reasonable, I guess. Did you consent to it? Well, yeah, I guess we consented to it. Well, then what's the problem? Well, the problem is our no good son-in-law did not advise us in writing about the need to obtain outside legal advice. And he hadn't. So rules are rules, and he wound up getting a private reprimand out of that, even though I think they probably realized that they were getting sucked into the fallout of this ugly divorce case. So what he should have done then, was just, written a thank you note saying, thank you very much for loaning us this money. It's great. It means our marriage will last forever. By the way, I hereby advise you that you should speak to your outside attorney. Then he would have been okay. So he forgot to do that, so he got reprimanded. So watch out. And also, I guess you think of it if you buy a car from your client. You probably, put something in writing saying, well, before we close on the car, you have the right to speak to an outside attorney. What if your client is the grocery store and you go in and buy a gallon of milk? Maybe the milk is bad, so you might have an adverse interest. So, maybe that should be written into the boilerplate of your retainer contract, because there's always that possibility of having an adverse interest to your client. So watch out for that. Can you get gifts from clients? Yes, you can. So if you have a millionaire client, they decide to give you $1 million, that's great. There's nothing at all wrong with that. But what you're not allowed to do is you're not allowed to solicit that gift. You can't say, boy, it sure would be nice if you gave me a lot of money today. You can't do that. And you can't draft the document putting that gift into effect. So in other words, you can't write a will naming yourself as a beneficiary. If your clients want to give you money in their will, that's great, but send them off to another attorney. Don't write that will for them. Unless there's an exception, In Minnesota and Iowa and Nebraska, it's easy. The exception is it's okay if they're a relative. Okay, so we'll move on. But now Wisconsin is a little bit different for you. But also, those of you in other states, I want you to listen to the Wisconsin version of the rule. Because as we'll see, the Wisconsin version of the rule might actually apply to you anyway. Because the subject matter of today's course is the ethics rules about whether or not you will get disbarred for drafting that will. And I'm telling you, as long as they're a relative, you will not get disbarred for drafting the will in any of those other states. And that's good. You don't want to get disbarred. But you want the money. You were supposed to get $1 million in this will. And that's a totally separate question. And that's not up to the Minnesota or Iowa or Nebraska Supreme Court. That's up to the probate court, whether or not you're going to get the money. And they will apply a different set of rules in deciding whether or not you get the money. Now, the reason why you should pay attention to the Wisconsin rule is because the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in deciding whether or not you're going to get disbarred for writing this will be applying the same rules applied by the Wisconsin Probate Court in deciding whether or not you get the money. So in other words, in Wisconsin, it's kind of an all or nothing proposition. Either you're exonerated, you're allowed to keep practicing law, and you get the money. Whereas in Minnesota, you might, you didn't get disbarred, but you don't get the money. Well, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has adopted the same rules in both categories, and chances are the probate court in Minnesota, Iowa, or Nebraska will be applying pretty similar principles, because this is some common law case from 1840 where these rules came up. The probate court in some other state is probably going to be applying pretty much the same rules. So let's take a look at the Wisconsin rule. So in other words, you write a will naming yourself as a beneficiary. Will you get disbarred in Wisconsin, or will the gift get thrown out in any state? It's okay as long as you have to meet the following tests. It's okay if the client is a relative, just like Minnesota. But not just any old relative. The relative must be, or you must be, the natural object of the bounty of the client. So that's, again, that language came from some case from 1840 or something, just meaning that it's a close relative who would normally be expected to give you a gift of about this size. So, yeah, you're drafting the will for your parents, and you're an only child, and you get their entire estate. Well, you're probably the natural object of that bounty. Whereas, you're drafting the will for your third cousin, and you get their entire estate. Well, even if your third cousin had some good reason for doing it, you're still not the natural object of the bounty. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court would disbar you, and the Minnesota Probate Court would throw out the will. So the person has to be a natural object to the bounty. The amount of the gift has to be reasonable and natural. There can't be any reasonable grounds to believe that the will be contested. And there can't be any reason to believe that the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar. Because, as you know, we as attorneys are highly respected. But if people learned about this will that you drafted, that might spoil it for all of us, and people would start telling lawyer jokes and everything. So if there's any possibility of that happening, the Wisconsin Supreme Court will disbar you, and the courts in every other state will throw out the will. So are there situations where you can draft a will naming yourself as a beneficiary? Yeah, probably. You're basically throwing yourselves on the unfettered discretion of a probate judge who may not like you. So if the probate judge gets a hold of this will and says, "Well, yeah, I guess you're supposed to get the money, except maybe the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar, so I better just play it safe and not let you have the money." You don't want that to happen, and these standards are not particularly objective. So if the probate judge does say that, you're probably not going to have much luck on appeal of that. So don't do it. In other words, is the short version of that. I'll just quickly sum up Rule 1.8 here. We're kind of getting up to the halfway point here. You can't receive literary rights based on the representation. The crime of the century takes place in your county, and the defendant wants to hire you, and they don't have any money to pay you, but they'll sign over the movie deal. Well, you can't do that. That's not permitted. You can't give financial assistance to a client other than a very limited, you have to comply scrupulously with the rule about advancing costs of litigation. Your fee being paid by somebody other than a client, can a third party pay your fee? Yes. The client has to consent to it. I don't see why they would say no. But more importantly, it can't interfere with your independence or with confidential information. If you are representing more than one party, then an aggregate settlement has to be approved by all of your clients. That kind of sounds common sense, but it's just reiterating that, yes, for example, one defendant has the right to say, no, I'm rejecting this settlement offer, I want to go to trial. Yes, every client has the power to do that. Whatever you do, never ask your client to prospectively waive malpractice claims or not to turn you into disciplinary authorities because, it's unenforceable, but it will just give them ideas. But more importantly, even asking that is a violation of the rules. So if you say, I didn't do anything wrong, so please don't turn me in, well, even if that's true, that's a violation of the rule. So don't do that. You can settle past malpractice claims, but if it's with an unrepresented person, you have to acknowledge that they should probably seek outside legal advice first. Never acquire a proprietary interest in a cause of action, except with a couple of technical exceptions, like your contingent fee or an attorney's lien. If you are related to another attorney through a familial or romantic capacity, basically you can't have cases against your related lawyer, even though that's been the theme of many a movie. That's supposed to happen. It can be consented to, possibly. A lawyer shall not have sexual relations with a client unless that relationship predated the legal representation. Before we take a break here, I'm just going to, actually right now would be a good time to take a break. So at this point, we will conclude part one of this program, and we will, I see my control panel is timed out. So what I'm going to do at this point, I'm going to finish up part one of the program, and then I'm simply going to hang up the phone, and we'll take about a 10-minute break. If you're taking the program live today, feel free to stay on the line if you would like, but I'm going to disconnect and then call back in about 5 minutes. So you can just wait on the line or call back in yourself in about 5 minutes. So thank you for listening to part one, and we'll see you back in a little bit for part two. Hi, I'm back. I'm going to put you on hold just for 1 second more, but I'll be back in a minute. Okay, I'm back. I'm sorry, I kind of unceremoniously just hung up on you there, but that was the only way I had to stop the recording. So I might have to do that at the end of this at this program as well, but we can follow up with everything by email. So anyway, I will just get my materials in front of me here again, and let's see, I'll just check one other thing here. Okay, I just wanted to check my email real quick. So we'll just pick up where I left off. I will start the recording again. And like I say, when I get to the end, if I remember to keep my internet thing going, I will end the recording properly, and then we'll conclude. But if I forget to do that, I might have to just hang up on you again. But we can follow up by email to get you set for the rest of the program. So I'm going to start the recording here again, and take it from there.